Good evening. This is Life Rattle, the story show. I'm your host, Lori Callis. Tonight, on Life Rattle number 1271, we present two stories by new Life Rattle writer Reed Domizar. Reed Domizar was born in a tiny apartment just off the Danforth in Toronto in 1981. At the age of 4, Reed moved with his mother and little sister to Collingwood, Ontario, where he lived until the age of 13, terrorizing the small town with elaborate pranks. Reed says he returned to Toronto as a troubled teen, just in time to flunk his high school career planning class, and, with the birth of his son in 2001, became a scrappy single dad. Reed began writing when, with his friends, he helped found Versus, a free magazine aimed at the skateboarding, snowboarding, and punk rock community. The magazine folded in 2006 after never making a dime. Reed Domizar currently works in the telecommunications industry and lives with his son and partner. Along with the two stories that we will hear on tonight's program, Reed submitted a story snippet titled "The Monkey That Was an Asshole." As soon as I read it, I wanted to roll this recollection of a life-altering childhood experience into Reed's bio, so here goes. "The Monkey That Was an Asshole" by Reed Domizar. When I was 3 years old, I went to the Toronto Zoo with my mum. It was warm, I remember that. The sun beat down on me in my blue shorts and red baseball cap. The air was full of summer smells. We strolled the grounds of the park, visiting the different animals, the elephants, the giraffes, the big cats, my little hand in her big hand. We reached the monkey cages. I raced excitedly towards the front, pumping my chubby toddler legs. I leaned into the bars, got in close. I could smell the thick animal smell, the stink of the wild that wafted out of the cage. To my delight, a little monkey, maybe it was a capuchin, shuffled over to me. We looked deeply into each other's eyes for a moment. I remember being fascinated by its sad, wrinkled monkey face, the darkness of its pupils under those thick brows. Without warning, it let out a heavy chortle and snatched my bright red baseball cap right off my head and pulled it through the bars, taking some of my bright blonde hair with it. The monkey began to eat my hat, nearly brand new, right in front of me. I was horrified. I didn't understand. Why was this happening? Why didn't somebody do something? I began to wail in anguish. Thick, blobby tears bounced down my cheeks. I could hear the crowd of people behind me start to laugh, a loud and joyful roar. Still chewing on my hat, thick drool dripping from its mouth, the monkey laughed too. This is my oldest memory, my first glimpse of how the world really works, and to this day I don't trust monkeys or humans. As you can already tell, Reed Domizar has a distinct voice. His quirky diction and larger-than-life delivery bring a wonderful sense of humor to his street-level stories. We'll begin tonight's show with a brilliant account of coitus interruptus. Let's listen now as Reed Domizar reads his story, Valkyrie versus Busybody, tonight on Life Rattle.
Valkyrie versus Busybody by Reed Domizar. It's late, 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 after a Friday night of too many drinks. Non-stop Ryan gingers, the ginger ale from the fountain tap having had no flavor and tasting like bitter bubbly water. I'm with Dee in her apartment, in her bedroom, in her bed, and we're busy, have been for a while. In the darkened room, lit only by the soft glow of the city streetlights, our booze clumsy and fatigue shambled state hardly matters. We're a tangle of body parts and stupid, blissed-out faces, shuddering and sweating, heaving and pressing, and it just doesn't stop until it does, with a loud, heavy thump on the front door. We both freeze in mid-push. I crane my head a little and can just make out a bulky silhouette framed through the window pane of the door. Dee moans beneath me, but now the sound means something else. "Oh my God," she whispers and rubs her face. Thump, thump. The two of us stay huddled and motionless in the bed. The thought of hiding under the covers until this late night cock block fucks off flashes through my brain. But our visitor persists. The thump's faster now. We unlatch from each other and disengage. Dee looks around wildly for her clothes. I toss her some underwear while keeping an eye open for my clothes. This is bad. I'm 17 years old all over again as we race to make ourselves decent. Dee beats me to it. She throws on a pair of pajama pants and half buttons a fuzzy cardigan, and then launches herself at the entrance. I pull on my own pants and stand awkwardly in the doorway of the bedroom as Dee swings open the door. Raylene, the trashy neighbor from downstairs with the squinty, mean-looking eyes and the fried mop of bleached blonde disarray, stands before Dee. She looks almost comical in her oversized blue Canada Goose coat with the fur-fringed hood up. She doesn't look happy. Dee doesn't even get to say anything before the tirade starts. "It's 3 o'clock in the fucking morning," Raylene spits. 3 o'clock. Listen, it's great that you love sex. I get it. I'm happy for you. But we're trying to sleep." Mouth bullets, that last part. I look over to Dee. She stands, arms crossed, gazing coolly at Raylene, who thunders on, waving her gloved hands around to punctuate every stupid thing she says. "Mornings, afternoons, nights. I wouldn't even care if you did it during normal hours. First it was Fridays, then Saturdays, now it's 3 days a week. Every week. We're all sick of it." "Don't you think this is a bit aggressive?" Dee responds, her voice quiet, low, calm in the way that when it's portrayed in comic strips, icicles hang from the bottom of the speech balloon. Raylene's face contorts into a reddish-pink smear. She casts me a baleful look, and instantly my balls contract. "Jesus, I'm staying out of this one." "Can't you go to his house? Does he even have his own place? Can you go to his parents? Everybody in the building thinks it's totally inappropriate, but I'm the only one with the backbone and the guts to say it." She jams a sausage thumb into her chest. "You're too loud. You should suck more dick." Raylene's out of breath now, and this last ridiculous statement hangs in the air for a beat before Dee says simply, "Noted," and closes the door. Dee strides back into the room, and I look at her, really look at her. Her long hair is wild. She's not wearing her glasses, and her high cheekbones and forehead have a faint shimmer to them, a glow. She smiles. Her sweater is open slightly, and I can see the faint curve of her small, beautiful breasts. Dee, my tall, elegant Romanian Valkyrie.
That was Valkyrie versus Busybody, written and read by Reed Domizar. Tonight's second story, about a beloved bike that goes missing from a storefront, will appeal to anyone who cycles in a big city. This misadventure story, full of hyperbole, indignation, frustration, and friendship, will have you gritting your teeth right along with our narrator as he combs the streets looking for his lost love. Let's listen now as Reed Domizar reads his story, Where is Ninja Bite?
Where is Ninja Bike? By Reed Domizar. Ninja Bike is gone. I stumble out of the corner store at Dufferin and College, clutching a medium triple-triple cup of coffee, and my beloved black hybrid bicycle is not leaning against the front window where I left her. The space is maddeningly empty now, just brick and glass, devoid of my bike. A few moments pass, and I remain rooted to the spot, looking at where she'd been, confusion stamped all over my tired mug. I don't know what to do. I check the street for her, half expecting to see that familiar low-slung frame, the space-age fenders that rise out of her at science fiction angles, her large, knobby tires, so perfect for navigating the broken, blistered terrain of Toronto city streets. But she is nowhere to be found. Where is Ninja Bike? Is this some sort of fucking joke? Where is Ninja Bike? I'm panicky, my mouth is dry, and my heart flops around in my chest like a dolphin in a landfill. I sweep my eyeballs up and down Dufferin, looking wildly for some trace of my missing two-wheeled treasure. I scrutinize the faces of pedestrians milling around the bus stop with suspicion. Nobody meets my eyes, but they are clueless. They don't see the mounting horror on my face, oblivious to this nasty business of a vanished bike. The truth sinks in when I spy the rusty, worn-out clunker propped drunkenly against a Canada Post mailbox 2 meters away. A crackhead's bike, no bigger than teen size, the type of cheap mass-produced mountain bike assembled lovelessly by minimum wagers in the back of Canadian Tires and Walmarts. Seeing this, I face the facts. Ninja Bike has been stolen. The evidence is undeniable. In a moment of carelessness, my back turned in buying coffee in the store she had been taken from me, rudely ripped off by some vile scumbag. A straight upgrade, the thief ditching his own crappy bike for my superior machine before speeding away. Fuck, fuck, fuck. I curse God and life and the motherfucking lack of honor prevalent in society. I curse bike thieves all over the world. Who steals a bike? Bottom-feeding shitbags so far down the criminal totem pole that they are virtually pariahs among the real crooks. I curse myself last for letting my guard down and not locking up this one fucking time the way I always do. I'm sick with the cyclist's malaise. Equal parts inconsolable despair and impotent rage. It all seems so fucking futile. Frustrated, I trudge home around the corner to my cramped two-bedroom apartment in the back alley, on legs that have forgotten how to walk. Legs that are weird and bend stiffly, like Bambi at the beginning of the Disney movie, wide-eyed and new, dripping placenta. It feels strange to arrive home with no Ninja Bike. I'm still holding my coffee, but I no longer feel like drinking it. It's a nice day and many of my neighbors are out, chatting around the community garden while their children run around playing scrappy alley kid games. Where's your bike? Asks my neighbor Lito. It just got stolen, I tell him, and saying the words out loud instantly make them true. From in front of the store. You didn't lock it up? His wife Linda chimes in. I shake my head no. Soon my neighbors, the working class denizens who live in the apartments behind college, and their many, many children crowd around me. I tell them what happened, and they offer me their condolences. Personal stories of the lowly bike thief as inescapable fact of life in the city get passed around. The children act shocked and indignant. Lito asks me if I want to hop in his car, a battered Toyota Corolla the color of a prairie fart, and cruise the neighborhood looking for the guy who took my bike, assuming the perp was male. It happened only a few minutes ago, he reasons, and he couldn't have gotten very far. I immediately agree. Our neighbors cheer and wish us good luck as we set out on our quest, peeling out of the alley and into the street thick with cars. I stew in the passenger seat as we drive, not saying much to Lito except to offer the occasional suggestion as to where we should go next. My head snaps back and forth, sweeping the road ahead of us with my gaze at laser beam intensity. I focus so intently on watching for any signs of the culprit and my bicycle that my eyes swim with tears. Where is Ninja Bike? We travel east on College, crawling through traffic, then north on Spadina before heading west on Bloor, a steady circuit of disappointment. Cyclists pass us on each side, but none of them are our prey, none of them my bike. I start to daydream about spotting the bike thief and leaping out of the car to tackle him onto the ground amidst the sea of cars, with no regard for my own safety. I devise cruel and unusual punishments for this shadowy bastard. I think up elaborate revenge schemes and torture-based poetic justice scenarios. What use does a man really have for his nipples, anyway? This provides some measure of comfort for a little while, but as the minutes tick on and on with still no sighting, I start to lose hope. With the late evening sun still beaming over top of this muggy muddle of cars, I reminisce about Ninja Bike and her 2 years of faithful service to me, the way she always rode true, strong, and reliable, the way I could sail her effortlessly through the same kind of snarled rush hour traffic we now found ourselves in, nimbly swooping around beached vehicles and careless jaywalkers at great speeds. I will miss her dearly. We drive back home, but I'm not ready to give up just yet. Let's just try Lansdowne and Bloor, I tell Lito. Lots of crackheads there. He nods. We roll up to the lights of the notorious intersection, a collection of dirty dive bars and sad, defeated takeout places, across from the burnt-out looking Coffee Time that perches on its southeast corner. It's a hideous landmark, this dirty, dingy donut shop, a symbol of the downtrodden neighborhood. And look, Ninja Bike. Across the street, in front of a fish and chips joint, 3 seedy-looking men in their mid-20s, dressed in tearaway track pants and baseball caps, stand around my bike. They talk excitedly while they inspect her with rough, uncaring fingers. There it is, I jab Lito, motioning for him to park. No double take necessary. I would recognize those proud fenders anywhere. Ninja. I march across the street in a pissed off, steady beeline on a collision course with this bunch of bike-stealing scoundrels. All at once I'm in front of them. I slap my left hand down heavily on the top bar of the bike, and they stop talking. The 3 men look at me in wide-eyed surprise. I recognize one of them from earlier. He'd been buying cigarettes in the convenience store. His eyes flash as he recognizes me, too. This is my bike, I spit through gritted teeth. My right hand balls tightly into a fist. I'm shaking, vibrating even. There's no mistaking my body language. I'm ready for a fight. The guy to my immediate right, chubbier than his companions, holds up his hands in a placatory gesture. We were just standing here. I don't listen. They hastily move out of the way as I swing Ninja Bike out on the sidewalk. I climb on. Before I peel off, I turn back and face the men, fixing them with my death dagger stare. They look back. They have no fucking idea of what is going on or who I am. They look bewildered, like stunned deer under the full furnace blast of my baleful hate lamps. I tell them one last thing and enunciate each syllable slowly, my voice getting louder and louder until it becomes a raspy roar. You fucking assholes. People on the street turn and look at us. The three lowlifes shuffle around uncomfortably under the greasy awning of the fish and chip shop. I shoot them the middle finger and then push off, leaving this godforsaken street corner and its coffee time and doomed inhabitants behind me in the dust. I soar south on Lansdowne, heading home, riding slowly at first, simply savoring the familiar feel of Ninja Bike beneath me, and then faster and faster, pumping my legs up and down and standing on the pedals. I feel my bitterness and anger melt away, replaced by simple, stupid joy. Holy fuck, I'd done it, gotten my bike back against impossible odds. Now nestled securely between my thighs, I coo to Ninja Bike in a gentle whisper. I tell her not to be scared, that she's safe now. I vow never to leave her unlocked ever again. Riding a bike never felt so damned good. I'm not much for smiling, but I grin the entire ride home all the same, like a toddler who'd shit himself.
That was Where is Ninja Bike? Written and read by Reed Domizar. That concludes Life Rattle number 1271. My name is Lori Callis. Life Rattle was created by Guy Allen and Arnie Achtman. Tune in next week to hear a treasure from the Life Rattle archive on Virginia Ashbury's Life Rattle Classics program.